From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the rules say family members of the Wayne County Treasurer may not take part in county foreclosure auctions. A Detroit News investigation finds County Treasurer Eric Sibri and his relatives are violating those county rules.
His argument is we want to sell properties to as many people as possible to get them back into positive reuse.
The State of the State speeches tonight. Governor Whitmer's got more than potholes on our roads to talk about.
There's potholes in how household income, potholes in the percentage of adults that are working, potholes in student achievement and funding in our K-12 schools.
Plus, the mid-century modern buildings of Midland.
This is a really unique feature to our city as our cities start to look like every other city. This is something that will always differentiate Midland from any other city.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The rules say family members of the Wayne County Treasurer may not take part in county foreclosure auctions. But a Detroit News investigation finds Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sibri and his relatives are violating those county rules. Sibri leads one of the biggest government foreclosure auctions in the country. Here with us is Detroit News reporter Christine McDonald. And Christine, the headline of your story in the Detroit News today is Wayne County Treasurer breaks tax auction rules. So let's get into these rules. First, there is a rule the Wayne County Treasurer Office has had for employees. What is that rule?
Yeah, the rule is that family members, it's a pretty big group, folks, of their, you know, not just immediate family members, wife and children, but also nephews, nieces, cannot buy or register as bidders. It's kind of a two-step process when they sell. You first register as a bidder, and sometimes real estate agents and attorneys register as a bidder. They bid on a property, and then the property goes, you know, in the name of someone else. So you can't bid and you can't buy at the auction if you're a relative. It's an auction rule. There's no listed penalties. So it's a little ambiguous about what would happen if that does happen. And we documented that it did happen in Sibri's family's case. So it's designed according to the past, you know, treasurer that I talked to, Ray Witovich, to deal with the perception that someone's got inside information, and so to instill trust in this process, which is a lot of people distrust because folks are losing their homes. Thousands have through this process for unpaid taxes, and there has been constant complaints about, you know, people who weren't noticed through the process, or people who felt, you know, that the city overassessed, you know, their properties, and that they lost their properties because of that, and that people, particularly poor people who could have qualified to not even pay taxes, shouldn't have even had to pay taxes, didn't know about it. So not all that is under the, you know, Sibri's umbrella. So a lot of that is in the county, but there are a lot of questions for many years that have surrounded this process.
And you discovered that Sibri was in violation of this rule. How so?
There are a couple instances. So his son, Adam, is an attorney in Metro Detroit. And in 2017, he was listed as a registered bidder at the auction. He paid, I think it was $9,000 for a house on the east side as a bidder. And then the property was deeded into the name of someone else. So him bidding would be a violation. Now, he maintains, this is Adam Sibri, maintains that he did not do that. He was just walking his client through the process, and somehow his name and information got in as a registered bidder. He also registered the previous year, but it doesn't look, in 2016, but it doesn't look like he actually bid that year. But that's what he's maintaining, that it was a mistake.
And your story talks about a real estate company called U.S. Development Services.
Yes. That is a company that Eric started back in 2002. He had just left working for then Mayor Dennis Archer, and it was kind of a development, you know, real estate company. He'd help folks get projects started. And then he said he handed it over to his wife completely in 2006 and was just had a minimal interest, but, you know, was considered a member of that company. Now, that company ended up buying 3 properties in 2011 from the auction while Eric was a deputy treasurer. So that, again, you know, initially Eric told me that the rules were in effect and that basically that would be a violation. But later he made an argument that because the auction that year was operated by a third party, that it wasn't a rules violation. So he's kind of waffled on that explanation there, that instance of his wife's company buying those properties.
And Christine McDonald, in your story in the Detroit News, you detail purchases of foreclosed properties, as you say, made by Sabree's relatives, including his wife and sons, and you found some of these properties were still delinquent on their property taxes. What did you find and what rule was broken here?
Yeah, these properties were for the most part chronically late on their taxes, and they would go through what's a process called pre-foreclosure. It's called forfeiture. So every year it's a formal process. There's a lien filed by the county in the county records that this property is going through the process. Now they would end up paying what they needed to pay to get it out of foreclosure, so the foreclosure didn't happen, but they were chronically late, these properties that were bought at auction. Two of these properties in Harper Woods, the company bought, U.S. Development Services, had a restriction in the deed that said you have to stay current for 2 years on this property. They put that into place in 2011 because so many people were buying properties and not paying taxes, and they would go cycle in and out of foreclosure, and it was a real problem, still is to some extent. So they could have seized those properties because they did not stay current on the taxes during those years. One of the properties is currently actually in Eric's name and his son's name, so they are listed as owners. So once I asked Mr. Sabree about it, you know, that is when 10 days later they paid the debt that was owed. There was a single vacant lot owned by his wife that escaped foreclosure even though it should have been foreclosed. It was not on a payment plan and it owed more than, you know, the 3 years taxes that could have qualified it for foreclosure. He says that that was a mistake and that his staff misapplied payments and that that's why it missed foreclosure, and explained it that way. So there were some properties that clearly could have been seized and weren't with these delinquent taxes.
So you've been digging, and as you point out, 10 days after you started asking about unpaid taxes, they were paid. So what did Sabree say about this story when you approached him?
Yeah, Sabree, we tried multiple times to interview him in person, but he refused and sent me a series of written statements based on questions we submitted to him. And he basically said that on those back taxes that he's like any other working family and that they have struggled with debt and that, you know, they paid it recently. And I think he also maintained that he didn't know his son had registered as a bidder, claims that he wouldn't have because his son is an attorney and, you know, he didn't want to violate attorney-client privilege. He said that he didn't feel that he needed to tell his boss at the time in 2011 when his wife's company purchased those Harper Woods houses. He didn't feel that he needed to disclose that to the former treasurer, Wei Witowicz.
And didn't he also say he plans to change the rule to allow employee family members?
Yeah, he feels the rule is too broad and that it covers too many folks. His argument is we want to sell properties to as many people as possible to get them back into positive reuse, and is planning to change the rule in this coming fall's auction. But let's remember, you know, the properties that were bought by his family and the company were chronically late in taxes and were cycling through the system and were saved just before foreclosure. So it goes to that heart of the problem people feel that there is in Detroit, where this is cycle of folks not paying taxes and these properties going through the process and blight follows. So I think that is one of the issues. There is a constant criticism of the auction that people don't pay their tax. You know, you're taking properties from people who are not paying their taxes and selling it to other people who are not paying their taxes, you know, and Sabree's families were some of those folks who were late, chronically late on taxes.
Christine, he made you submit questions in writing. He wouldn't talk with you directly, but he did speak with the Detroit Free Press, which published a parallel story. So what's that all about? Why did he comment to them and not to you?
Yeah, you'll have to ask him why. I don't know. I've been covering that office and him for almost probably 7 years, and he's never refused an interview with me until this topic. I was surprised that he took basically all the investigation and the work that I had done and presented it to the Free Press. And he expressed regret over some of these things. And frankly, in our conversations for several weeks and the written statements, he never expressed that to me in response to my questions. And I did ask questions open-ended questions about this process, and so I am surprised to hear him express those things to the Free Press in their story today.
I am interested in just getting a sense of, you talked to a number of legal and public policy experts, including Peter Henning, a Wayne State law professor and former federal prosecutor. He thought this didn't appear to be an obvious ethical violation. What do some of the other experts say to you?
Yeah, to recap, he felt that this auction is open to the public, so anyone can bid, so it's not an obvious ethical violation, but others feel there is a problem in terms of perception, that if you talk to anybody on the street and tell them the scenario of a treasurer who doesn't pay his taxes and then has family members who are bidding on properties that he foreclosed on, there's going to be a perception that there's something else going behind the curtain here in this process and that maybe somebody has an advantage here. So I think that is the main problem. It's a perception problem, and that rule, and according to Wojtowicz, that rule was there for that reason, because he did not want people to think that there were people that had an advantage over others. And, you know, Peter Hammer, similar name but different guy at Wayne State, said that that's part of the problem, that there has to be a public confidence in the system for it to work, that everyone has the same advantage at the auction to bid on these properties for this market to work. And if people have the perception that's not the way it works and that breaks down.
I've been speaking with Christine McDonald of the Detroit News about her story on Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sabree and his family breaking tax auction rules. Christine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You know Valentine's Day is at hand, when the candy aisles at the grocery store are just packed with pink and red, and you turn on TV and it's jewelry and flower commercials. With this love in the air, we want to hear from you. What do you think is the most romantic spot in Michigan and why? Let us know, and you just could hear your answer on the air. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Give us your name, where you live, and your choice for the most romantic place in Michigan. You can also record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us, stateside@michiganradio.org, or just type in your response in the box right at the top of the Stateside page, once again, at michiganradio.org. Coming up, the Midwest was home to some of the giants of mid-century modern architecture and design. Eero Saarinen, Minoru Yamasaki, and Alden B. Dow, just to name a few. And there are few places where that legacy is as obvious as in Dow's hometown of Midland, Michigan.
This is every part of Midland. It's doctor's office, it's schools, it's houses, it's fire stations. You know, it's the church people go to.
Documenting Midland's mid-century modern architecture. That's ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time to talk theater, checking out what some of Michigan's professional theater companies are doing in February. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us, and we're starting with a play that made a spectacularly good transition to film. I'll tell you, if I spot Steel Magnolias anywhere on the cable guide at any time, at what point it is, I am in. I love this story.
Well, then you should go to the Dio in Pinckney, because that's where the play is playing. This is the Robert Harling play that, as you say, made into the much-loved movie with Julia Roberts, Sally Field, Shirley MacLaine. The thing that will shock people who've never seen the play is that, of course, it all takes place in the beauty parlor. All of the action. And this is a story of the woman, you know, type 1 diabetes, she's getting married, and then she gets pregnant. But mostly
Shelby,
yes.
Who loves pink. Go ahead.
But mostly it's really about the bond among the women, the Southern women. And I have to say the Dio does this kind of play very well, in part because they always have this wonderful company of actresses that are frequently cast in their shows there. This is no exception. It's an absolutely terrific cast. And it's a dinner theater, and they're known for their fried chicken,
okay,
which goes with the Southern theme. Got to say, it's a lovely show, good food, and just a total great experience out.
All right. And next up, we go to Ann Arbor to Theater Nova. What are they doing?
So this is a relatively new play by a playwright named Sarah Treem. And it's a two-person play, intimate conversations between two female biologists. And one's older, one's younger. And they have competing theories about the evolutionary origins of menstruation. Now, before the men in the audience write this off as a woman's play, it's not. It's a – well, it is, but it's highly, highly recommended for everybody. The play explores attitudes and personal choices that women of any generation face, such as men, marriage, family, career, professional recognition. Our critic says it's "don't miss this." Hmm. Basically, was in her review, and you know, it's two combustible characters, scientists, and the Theater Nova space is so intimate. It's like having a ringside seat for a match of Survival of the Fittest, and it's very well written.
So this crackling energy comes right off to you. So that's Sarah Treem's The How and the Why at Theater Nova. And now over to Chelsea to the Purple Rose.
Yes, brand new play premiere written by Carrie Krim, who's Michigan born and raised. And this is a story of a daughter of an interracial lesbian couple who comes home from college with a boyfriend, declares that she's hired a private investigator to help her find her biological father. Birth mother says she can't recall the name of the man who was kind of a forgettable college one-night stand. But her other mother reveals what might be the man's name. And so the play unfolds around her search, what she finds out, the conflict between the two mothers and the daughter. This cast, terrific. Michelle Mountain and Cassandra Freeman play the mothers. Caitlin Cavanaugh as the daughter. Our reviewer also highly, highly, highly recommends this play.
You don't often get many swings and a miss out of the Purple Rose, do you?
No, not many.
And now we go to Dexter to the Encore Musical Theater.
Yeah, a little bit of music. We've been talking about plays. So this musical, Next to Normal, which is a musical that centers around a mother who struggles with a worsening bipolar disorder and the effects of her illness on the family. And the music really includes some fast-paced rock music that, in fact, some people refer to it as a rock musical. It's a very powerful story. I've seen it elsewhere. Again, our reviewer said this production at the Encore Musical Theater is dynamite. If you know somebody with bipolar disorder, you know it's rough for both the person and the people who are close to them. And this musical, I've seen it, it really manages to capture the reality of all of this. It's special.
And it, boy, I remember it was nominated for 11 Tony Awards in 2009, and it won 3, and it won the Pulitzer for Drama the following year. So it's got a great pedigree.
Can you tell me what it is you're afraid of? Can you tell me why I'm afraid it's me? Can I touch you? We've been fine for so long now. How could something go wrong that I can't see? 'Cause I'm holding on, and I won't let go. I just thought you should know.
And that was a clip from the original cast of Next to Normal. That does sound good, and certainly with all those awards, it's worth seeing. Over to the Fisher Theater in Detroit, what's coming up?
Yeah, this
besides is... besides Hamilton, which is all anybody's talking about.
Yes. So there's a play that's been on Broadway. Now it's gone into regional distribution and touring. It's called The Play That Goes Wrong. It's still playing on Broadway. This is British farce that the play began in London. It's made a very successful migration across the pond. So the setup for this is an amateur troupe, the Cornley University Drama Society, and they've miraculously managed to land a big theater for a thriller, The Murder at Haversham Manor. You know, it's a country house whodunit, kind of in the tradition of The Mousetrap. But part of the fun is how this very questionable troupe manages to dismember a beautiful manor house set. Everything goes wrong. Reminds me a bit of Noises Off, you know, so it's a lot of fun. Not a tear in the theater unless it comes from laughing.
All right, so that's The Play That Goes Wrong, and coming to the Fisher February 13th. What about Valentine's Day?
Yeah. So down at the Planet Ant, which is a very fun venue in Hamtramck, they have two one-act plays that are love and Valentine related. The first one's called Love, Lust, and Lunacy. It's a one-act play. And it's really just it's about relationships. It's funny. You know, the Planet Ant, that's their stock and trade. And then there's another interesting one act called He Said Yes. And the timing for this, given everything going on in society, is kind of funny. It's meant to be funny, which is it's two longtime coworkers. They're discovered having a workplace affair. And through company policy, they're forced to recount the progression of their affair in an office investigation. But it's funny. Both are funny.
It's funny. And that's at Planet Ant.
Planet Ant in Hamtramck. And it's a very fun theater. If you haven't been there, give it a try. This would be a good week to do it.
Well, plenty of variety on this month's picks. And you can get all the information on these and other plays being done around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Colley, as always, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
From furniture showrooms to fashion aisles to television shows like Mad Men and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, mid-century modern style and design is seeing a renaissance in recent years. For people living in Midland, these clean, sleek lines have always been a part of everyday life. This city has a unique concentration of mid-century modern buildings. And over the past 2 years, volunteers have been heading out into Midland to document the city's architectural treasure trove. Craig McDonald is the director of the Alden B. Dow Home and Studio in Midland. Craig, where'd the idea come from to survey these mid-century structures?
You know, we've always known of Mr. Dow's structures here, and because he's the one who brought modernism to Midland, but we also knew and were aware of that there were so many other architects and designers who contributed to this unparalleled collection of mid-century structures, and we said we need to really document it now. We need to let people know about it because it's such an unusual collection. Just it's so rare in the United States to have so many of one style in one city.
Is there any kind of head count, the number count that you might have an idea how many mid-century structures we're talking about?
To date, we have documented 423.
Mm. And that is, as you say, an unusually high concentration.
It is. It's because it's so integrated to every part of our community here. It's not just one, you know, three-block radius, kind of like Oak Park, which is spectacular outside of Chicago that features all, you know, a lot of Wright's early work. This is every part of Midland. It's doctor's office, it's schools, it's houses, it's fire stations. You know, it's the church people go to. So it's really, we just accept it as part of our landscape. Yet it's so unusual and so unparalleled.
And tell us more about Alden B. Dow, this man who really, as you say, brought this to Midland.
Yeah, Alden Dow, who is the architect laureate of the state of Michigan, he just had different ideas about architecture. He thought that especially a house could be more than just a shelter, that if it was designed right for particular individuals, it could help us grow spiritually, physically, and emotionally, and plus function. It was form and function working together. He studied for a short time with Frank Lloyd Wright, and learned well from Mr. Wright, and just redefined architecture. And then other young people saw this, and they were really engaged by his designs, by the function. And so other people came to Midland and worked with him and then went off on their own, and they helped create this collection. So he really is the beginning and the impetus for it, but Midland is so much more than just Mr. Dow's work. It's this influence that he had as well.
Who are some of the other architects that their work stands out?
You know, we just have a phenomenal array. We've been able to identify 38 architects and an additional 7 designers and engineers who also design here. So Jackson Hallett, Francis Red Warner, Glenn Red Beach, Robert Schwartz, Carl Schulwitz. I mean, the list goes on and on. And we learned so much about architects we had no idea about.
Now, what are the defining features of modernism, of mid-century architecture?
You know, I think when we look at mid-century architecture, there are some traits, and these are the traits that we gave to our volunteers who canvassed our whole city, neighborhood by neighborhood, structure by structure. There's always a strong horizontal orientation. There are clean lines and a lack of ornamentation. There's an integration into the site. typically a large chimney mass that somewhat anchors the house. And then there's repetition of features like windows and roof lines and a real combination of quality materials. And that's one thing, you know, Midland has kind of its own definition of mid-century modern design because the quality of materials was just so paramount to all the people who designed here. So it's a little bit different than how we would define mid-century in other areas.
And what was the thinking behind this school of design? What were they trying to say in the 1950s?
You know, I think they were trying to say that there was a different way to live and a different way to define buildings. That it wasn't just about show. It was about how does a house function? How is it connected to the outdoors because it was such a healthy way to live? But it's really that form and function working together as our country was redefining. And that's, you know, really the impetus, all this new technology that the war brought, and to say there's a different way to live and let's be functional and incorporate beauty at the same time.
So how many volunteers were out there plugging away for the last couple of years?
You know, we've been so fortunate. We had 30 volunteers. We called them scanners because we broke the city down into parcels maps, and they truly went structure by structure, and we gave them those tenants we just talked about, what were the physical characteristics. So if a building had even one, we wanted them to submit that building. So they submitted over 892 structures. Then we had a review committee with architects and design professionals that we went through structure by structure, one by one, and saw a photo of it to determine if it was mid-century or not. And then it went into our new website and now our new mobile app, so you can look all this up and take tours, and it's just so much fun.
Yeah, tell us about the app so people can kind of make something of all this information that your volunteers found.
Yeah, happy to. The app is Mid-Century Midland, and you can get it through the Apple Store or through Google. And you can look structures up by building type, by architect. You can look it up by the street name. You can look it up by the original owner's name. And like our database, you can access all that. And there's a picture of every structure. It tells you who designed it. It tells you what year, any other information we have. What the app has, in addition to what the website has, is that you can actually tour. We have predetermined or pre-selected tours where there are high concentrations of structure or like a religious structure tour. But then even better is you can customize a tour on the app to say, what architect do I want? What building type? Then it will show you all the things they did, and then you select which ones you want to see, and then it routes it in the most efficient route, and then it sends it to Google Map. So then from wherever you're standing or sitting, you can then go see the structures.
Were you surprised at how many structures were turned up once those volunteers got out there and started coming back with their findings?
You know, we were. We were very surprised because some are just so woven into neighborhoods, and you know, you don't see every structure in a city, and we were just stymied actually by the number. And we found a couple of architects we had never heard of before who have more than 15 or 20 structures in our city, and it was, again, all this new information. We're learning about them as individuals, as designers. We're also learning about the builders, just the quality craftsmen that were here. So it's just been such a delight to learn more every day about this process and about the people who created them.
You know, as you talk, I hear your excitement and your passion for modernism, for mid-century design and architecture. What speaks to you about that? And I guess what I'm asking you is to people who say, you know what, I look at this and I just don't get it. What do you say to them?
You know, I think that, like anything, I have appreciation for people who think in a different way, who give us new definitions. Doesn't mean that I have to love a new definition, but I so appreciate that someone was willing to say, hey, we can do something in a better way, or they thought it was a better way, and they actually went out and did it. And that's what modernism is to me. Some people still love I love traditional architecture too, but I have this appreciation for modernism because it was a different way of thinking, and it's so functional. And Midland is so unique because it has such a concentration concentration. Mr. Dow would always say, you know, let's retain what's unique about Midland. Midland is this science town. It's a town of education, of family. But part of our definition is to stay unique. That we, Mr. Dow, Alden Dow, and his father before him, Herbert Dow, created new definitions for the world. And this is a really unique city that is good at creating definitions. And so it's not that you have to love it, but wow, this is a really unique feature to our city. As our cities start to look like every other city, this is something that will always differentiate Midland from any other city.
Do you have a favorite building?
Oh, you know, I have to say it's the Alden Dow Home and Studio. The thing I love about the studio is when you come driving down Post Street, you instantly start to ask questions, and that's what Mr. Dow wanted. He wanted us to think for ourselves. He wanted us to go forward and challenge the world to create new ideas, because that's how we grow as humans. And so this building still has that power to make you question about buildings and design and color and light. And everyone who enters it, maybe you're thinking, oh, I'm going to go to a historic house. But by the time they leave, they don't want to leave. They're like, wow, this was so exciting. And they're already thinking about buildings and how space impacts us as humans.
And again, the app is called Mid-Century Midland, so I assume that's pretty available?
Yeah, Mid-Century Modern Midland. Yes.
Mid-Century Modern Midland, and the result of 2 years of volunteers heading out, crisscrossing the city of Midland, documenting the treasure trove of mid-century architecture. And we've been talking with Craig McDonald, who's the director of the Alden B. Dow Home and Studio in Midland. Thanks so much for sharing this work with us, Craig.
Thank you so much. Just get out there, use the app, and have a great time.
And you can see photos of some of Midland's vast collection of mid-century modern architecture. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Still to come, Governor Whitmer prepares to give her first State of the State speech tonight. We'll get a preview of just how Michigan is doing. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a little over 3 months since people in Benton Harbor learned a number of homes in their city had elevated levels of lead in their drinking water. Since then, there's been more testing. Of some 300 samples, more than 50 homes showed elevated lead levels. As Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer tells us, it's a situation that could become more common in Michigan as water systems all around the state get older.
William Thomas opens the front door of his house on the south side of Benton Harbor and leads the way to the kitchen. He has on a dark gray collared shirt, a white goatee, and gold-rimmed glasses. He sits down at a round table with a stack of papers stuck to a clipboard. He pulls one out, a white sheet that was sent to him in the mail last fall.
This is my results.
Thomas and his wife got their drinking water tested after the city first announced in October that it had found elevated lead levels in several homes in the city.
And the results were saying that anything over 15, you know, that you were in trouble.
15 parts per billion is the level of lead in water that's considered the, quote, action level by the EPA. It's the point at which steps need to be taken. Thomas's water had lead at more than twice that level. His number was 34.
Well, right away, what I did was I started calling people.
He called the county. He says he called the state of Michigan. He got directed back to the city, and he didn't have any luck. Finally, he heard the city was holding a public meeting, so he went to that. At the meeting, residents found out what the city's been up to. Lots more testing and digging, literal digging, in the ground to investigate and remove water lines that may have lead in them. City Manager Darwin Watson says the city has gotten a jump on replacing water lines thanks to a grant from the state that was awarded last summer.
That grant gave us about $280,000. What they're requiring from the cities, what the state is requiring from the city, is that the replacement go from meter to main. Rough estimate, ballpark, is that's about $5,000 per line.
And the city has more than 2,500 water lines, Watson says. No one knows which ones or how many might have lead in them. That's because decades ago, when the water lines first went in, no one thought lead was something worth keeping track of. What the city has to do now is go line by line, starting with the more than 50 homes like William Thomas's, where the water has tested high for lead, And the state grant money won't be enough to do all the work.
So now what we're going to have to do going forward after that is there's going to have to be dollars allocated out of the general fund budget, out of the budget of the city, to address that because the state's going to mandate it. So it will be done. It'll just be in phases, if you will.
The reason all this matters, even if you don't live in Benton Harbor, is because of how Benton Harbor found itself with a lead problem in the first place. The story is very different from what happened in Flint, where a disastrous decision to switch water sources led to the crisis. What happened in Benton Harbor was nothing. Nothing changed. Water treatment was the same. The water source was the same, drawn from Lake Michigan like always. And still, the levels of lead went up. Maybe it's that the pipes are getting older and the deterioration of the lead has accelerated. Maybe it's just that the testing for lead has gotten better. No one in the city or at the state really knows right now. What everyone does know, with at least a little certainty, is that this won't be the last city in Michigan to have a lead problem in the water. And the problems, when they're found, are a lot more likely to look like Benton Harbor's problems than Flint's. For the Environment Report, I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Michigan Radio senior editor Sarah Hewlett is here with us now. Sarah, just how did Benton Harbor figure out that it had a problem with lead in water?
So we've got this federal law. It's called the Lead and Copper Rule. And under that law, most cities test for lead once every 3 years. So 2018 was Benton Harbor's year. And it's worth pointing out here that cities are only required to test really just a small fraction of homes to comply with the law. Benton Harbor initially tested 30 homes. Enough of them came back at a high enough level for lead to put it over what the EPA calls its action level. What that means is that the city has to notify residents. So that's the letter William Thomas got in the mail back in October. Then Benton Harbor tested more homes just on its own, voluntarily. It tested almost 300. That testing found 50 homes that tested above the federal action level. And by the way, in terms of this 2018 testing, Benton Harbor is not the only city that exceeded the action level. Here in Southeast Michigan, Hamtramck did. Also in Southwest Michigan, which is obviously where Benton Harbor is, we saw Parchment and Lawrence. All of those cities went over the action level in the last testing round. And then you've got places that are doing testing beyond what the law requires. So you might remember that last year, Detroit Public Schools did that voluntary testing at a bunch of its schools. Like two-thirds of them came back with elevated lead levels.
I remember all the kids all had to go on bottled water.
Right. And parents were wondering, what is going on? What changed? I think the takeaway here is, if you are looking for lead in water, you are likely to find it.
And didn't the state adopt tougher lead rules last year, Sarah?
Yep. So what those rules say is that by 2025, Michigan is going to drop its action level to 12 parts per billion for lead. The federal level is 15 parts per billion. So Michigan will have a stricter standard than the feds. And then this is a big deal. Cities have to replace 5% of their lead lines every year for the next 20 years. That's an effort to take out this main source of lead in water.
And just to get everyone on the same page, remind everybody what a lead service line is.
Sure. So in a water distribution system, you've got the water main. That's the big pipe that runs underneath the road or street in front of your house. And then the lead service line, that's what we're talking about here, is the pipe that takes the water from the main into your house. And in a lot of older cities, those are made out of lead. And it's worth pointing out, this was the main culprit in Flint. It's not actually in Flint that the water that left the treatment plant there had lead in it. It's that when the city switched sources, remember, from treated water from Detroit in 2014 to the Flint River, that river water was corrosive. And what happened is it stripped away this protective coating that these pipes build up inside them. And that meant that lead from the pipes could leach out of those service lines and get into the tap water.
And finding those lead lines can be a real challenge.
Yeah. Yes. The hard truth is that lots of cities don't actually know where their lead lines are. So they don't know if your house is one they should be testing as part of this mandatory compliance. Our newsroom, led by Lindsay Smith and Kayla Fond, did an analysis last year. It showed that most Southeast Michigan cities, 60% of them, did not know where their lead lines are. However, you can figure it out yourself. You can go to our website where we've put an app that NPR built. It helps you figure out if you have a lead service line to your house. I actually used this when I was editing our stories about Flint and figured out that we here at our house have a lead service line.
Short of waiting for someone's city to replace it, is there anything that we can do to protect ourselves?
Yes. You can run your tap every morning. So whatever water has been sitting in that lead service line gets flushed out. That's what we do at our house every morning. You can also filter your water. You can get one that fits right on your faucet, or you can get one of those pitcher filters. They're pretty affordable. They're widely available. You want to check to make sure that it's NSF certified. That just means it's been tested to actually do what it says it'll do. And if you're in one of those cities that went over the action level, you actually might be able to get a filter from the city or from the county. I know in Benton Harbor, Berrien County is giving out filters. And in Hamtramck, anyone whose home tests over the action level can get one. That's according to the letter that they sent out to residents.
Michigan Radio Senior Editor Sarah Hewlett. Thanks so much, Sarah.
You're so welcome.
Gretchen Whitmer was elected governor by, in part, promising to fix the damn roads. As she prepares to deliver her first State of the State speech tonight, Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business has prepared his review of the potholes that line Michigan's economic path, problems facing our new governor and her team. Chad's here now via Skype. You know, Chad, we hear politicians and business leaders and education leaders talk a lot about making Michigan a top 10 state. Realistically, how far are we from that laudable goal?
We're pretty far on several different fronts in measurements that we would count as meaningful measurements of economic prosperity. You know, my story, I said there's potholes in household income, potholes in the percentage of adults that are working, potholes in student achievement and funding in our K-12 schools, and just a general pothole in the number of people who actually are qualified to work. We have an employment to population ratio of less than 58%, ranks us 38th in the country. It's behind the national average, and it's well behind what our Midwest rival Minnesota is at. Two-thirds of their residents are working, and that shows up in the median the household income that people have. In Minnesota, people make 15% more on average in their household incomes at $68,000 a year. We're under $55,000. At the same time, this education attainment really is hampering the state, and you can see it in the data. We're at less than 44% of our residents have either a bachelor's, associate's, or some type of high-level credential. We rank 36 in the country in that category, well behind Minnesota, Illinois, even Iowa and Kansas and Ohio. We only rank better than Indiana in that key category. And that shows up in our earnings and the type of jobs we have. 62% of Michigan residents are working in a job making less than $20 an hour, according to the Michigan Association of United Ways in their annual survey, where they kind of assess what is, who's making ends meet, basically, in Michigan.
And so often we will hear members of, for example, of the Snyder team, or you'll hear, people in the business community saying, look what we've done. We've been able to replace like 7 in 10 of the jobs that were lost in the Great Recession.
Yeah, but we've replaced them with lower paying jobs. We didn't replace them with the there's not as many of those $25 an hour jobs at the GM factory anymore. In fact, based on what's going on at GM right now, they're laying off some of the white collar workforce as well. So we have just a populace that's not prepared for the jobs of the future. That's why you just see more and more almost crisis mode in employers right now, trying to find qualified people for all sorts of jobs. And that all comes back to that education attainment level, which I think tonight we're going to hear from the governor. She's going to talk about that. I'm told that she's going to actually call for a goal of 60% of residents in the state having some type of higher education level by 2030. And a lot of states have pushed for a 60% goal by 2025. Since we're behind and it's almost the end of this decade, they're setting a goal for 11 years from now, trying to get to that 60% mark.
We have a long way to go. What do we have? Something like 43.7% right now?
Yeah, we're at a little under 44%. So yeah, there's a long ways to go. The governor is going to propose some ideas that she talked about in the campaign, having a scholarship basically to try to would cover the cost of going to community college, and also a scholarship job training program to try to get some folks in their 30s and 40s, even in their 50s, retrained for jobs now. That's one of the bigger challenges you see in this data, is you have a whole generation of people who basically got kind of left behind either by automation, globalization, or they just did not pursue education after high school. And as a result, they're kind of relegated to lower wage jobs. And so that's the effort that the governor is going to try to push for, in addition to the roads, Cindy. Let's not forget about them. The pavement crisis, essentially, in this state is getting worse. We all know it. We all see it. And the governor is expected to talk about that, kind of talk about the magnitude of the problems. But here's a couple of numbers. Right now, on state trunk line roads, that's your interstates, your highways, your Michigan Avenue, Washtenaw Avenue, such, those roads all have about 79% of them are in good or fair condition. But MDOT projects, based on the current spending and current funding plans, that by 2021, just a couple years from now, 57.5% of them will be in good condition. And then by 2028, it'll totally flipped on its head, and 57% of those trunk line roads will be in poor condition. So even with the plan that the legislature passed back in 2015, the $1.2 billion plan,
right,
the money's not coming in fast enough, essentially. And because of that, the road crews and the construction companies can't keep up with the deterioration of the pavement. That's kind of a result of just a decade or more of disinvestment in roads.
I think no one listening will argue against the fact that the roads are getting worse, and certainly even our last couple of weeks of weather have not helped. Do we have any hints, and might we expect that tonight from the governor as far as how she will fulfill that core campaign promise and work with the Republican legislature?
She's saving that for the budget address in March, which will be the first Tuesday in March when she'll lay out her first budget plan. So she's not going to get into details tonight about how much she proposes the legislature raise or how to raise the money. And I think that's going to be kept for another day and another fight.
Yeah. So this tonight, this is kind of her view. This is what I see, spelling out maybe some of the things you're talking about right here as far as the potholes that are on the road to Michigan's economic future.
That would be the gist of the speech tonight, is really kind of laying the groundwork so they can kind of try to set a common agenda and goal. And we'll see what lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are up for. The road debate has been going on for years. I just kind of recounted in some tweets today about how there was a report back in 2011 known as the Olson Report. Rick Olson, a Republican from Saline, who wrote this report saying we needed $2.2 billion. That was 8 years ago, and here we are still kind of arguing about it. It seemed like the end of the decade, and we don't really have quite a plan yet. And I would expect that this governor is going to try to focus the community and the public on that.
Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business. As always, Chad, thank you so much.
Take care.
And don't forget, we're waiting to learn your pick for the most romantic spot in Michigan, and you have to tell us why you chose that spot. Just leave us a voicemail. Here's the number to call, 734-764-7840. Give us your name and where you live and why you've chosen this place as the most romantic spot in Michigan. If you also feel like it, you can type a response at the box at the top of the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Today's program was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Bella Isaacs, Rosie Joffrey, Sarah Leeson, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.